Palestinian factions call for a day of rage in Gaza and the occupied West Bank over a planned march by Israeli settlers in East Jerusalem al-Quds. Canadian authorities bring terrorism charges against a man accused of murdering four members of a Muslim family in Ontario. The Yemeni army says it has carried out a fresh retaliatory drone strike hitting Saudi Arabia's Apa International Airport. Good to have you with us. Our top story, Palestinian factions have called for protests in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank on Tuesday over a planned march by Israeli settlers in eastern Jerusalem al-Quds. The Hamas and Fatah movements have urged the Palestinians to flock to Jerusalem's old city to counter the settlers' march. Protests have also been planned in the Gaza Strip. Hamas has warned of renewed hostilities if the event dubbed March of the Flags goes ahead. Separately, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shatayeh has warned about dangerous repercussions of the march. The Israeli media say the regime has made preparations for a possible escalation in Gaza over the march, which was originally due to take place last Thursday but was delayed. Rabbi David Feldman is the spokesman at the Nitre Carter International, joining us out of New York. Rabbi, welcome. What's your views on this march, which essentially is surely going to increase tensions in at a time where, you know, it's very hostile, the environment there in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds?
Well, this is truly outrageous. This is a march which is going to take place now, planned to take place after these marches that did take place early May, just a couple of weeks ago, and we saw, unfortunately, what the outcome was of it. So many people were killed, so much casualty, so much bloodshed, so much misery because of these reckless marches of provocation to make this statement and to fight against the Palestinian neighbors. Unfortunately, when we're talking about a day of rage, this might be a month of rage, this might be a year of rage, this is already going on for decades. This is truly outrageous. And sadly, when this is being done by this settler movement, which they come out in this religious way and they try to present this radicalism, this extremism, this terrible behavior, and they try to show this with a religious face. This is truly embarrassing to Jewish people. I'm sure that many people are not aware, there was Aida Haredes, the anti-Zionist rabbinate in Jerusalem. In the beginning of May, just a couple of weeks ago, they issued a statement condemning those marches that started at the time, condemning that. But we have to be very clear that when we are talking about the settler movement, unfortunately, they are very, they're coming out in public and they're very radical and they're very obvious. But it's not only the radical movement that the Jewish people are so upset with, it's the entire occupation, which is anti-God, it's against Judaism, and it's totally wrong, and this has to stop. And as Jewish people, we come out in public already for the last couple of weeks, and it's already for the last decade, since the 1930s, before the creation of the State of Israel. And we say this publicly and loudly, that the State of Israel is not representing all Jews. This is against Judaism. It's a violation of international law and is a violation of Jewish law.
Rabbi, just how extreme is the ideology of these settlers who are marching in what freedom-loving people around the world, as well as the Palestinians, consider as Palestinian Jerusalem al-Quds, but the international community, the Western as part of the section of the international community, consider Eastern Jerusalem al-Quds as belonging to the Palestinians, despite it being occupied. How extreme are these settlers?
Well, you know, We as religious Jewish people truly believe that this occupation in its entirety is wrong, and all of Palestine needs to be returned to the Palestinian people. This is Jewish and this is just. But even if you would take that approach that others will take, that we need to divide Palestine into two, even though we can argue whether that's going to work or it won't, but taking that extreme stance that going even into Palestinian territories and even do the provocations in there, you know, they are very publicly and clearly making a statement that not only they don't want peace with the Palestinians, but they are willing to destroy anything which is already achieved or existing.
Okay, Rabbi, thank you very much indeed for your thoughts there. Rabbi David Feldman, a spokesman from the Nitre Carter International, joining us live from New York. Now, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has hailed the end of Benjamin Netanyahu's 12-year rule in Israel, referring to him as a tyrant who has fallen. On his Twitter account, Zarif said Netanyahu's ouster followed several years of wars and aggression against the Palestinians and threats to the Islamic Republic. He added the scenario indicates that while the tyrant has fallen, Iran continues the march of glory and the Gaza Strip is raising the sign of victory. The top Iranian diplomat expressed hope that Netanyahu's successors would learn that the Israeli regime, which was founded on the basis of aggression and occupation, will not last long. On Sunday, the Israeli parliament voted in favor of a new coalition cabinet, ending Netanyahu's 12-year tenure as prime minister. Journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas says Benjamin Netanyahu was behind numerous atrocities in the West Asian region, and if it was not for Iran, his balkanization plots would have succeeded.
The truth is, a lot of what Israel does is through proxies, and most of, if you like, the millions of deaths across the West Asian region, the Arab region, and beyond, could easily, if you wanted to really do a proper money trail or a real search of the links that all these forces have had, have created murder, mayhem, torture across West Asia, whether it's Daesh, whether it's Al-Qaeda, whether it's the MKO, whether you want to go to any other group which has created huge, if you like, violence in the region, or, for that matter, the despots and the other tyrants like the Sisis of the world and the Mubaraks of the world over the past, from Egypt to Afghanistan, Israel has had his hand behind it, and Netanyahu, during his 12-year office, has been one of the worst culprits in unleashing these demons across West Asia. And had it not been for the Islamic Republic of Iran and its stoic resistance in Yemen, notably, Syria, notably, of course, Lebanon, and now Palestine, most recently, Iraq, not forgetting Iraq, of course, without the backbone of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Israel would have got away with this balkanization, murder, and terrorizing policies.
Elsewhere, Canadian authorities have brought terrorism charges against the man accused of murdering four members of a Muslim family in Ontario. Prosecutors said the new charges against 20-year-old Nathaniel Veltman are in addition to first-degree murder and attempted murder charges already filed against him. The man was arrested on June the 6th, shortly after he ran over a family of five with his pickup truck. A five-year-old boy survived the attack and has been discharged from hospital. Police later said the attack was premeditated and characterized as a hate crime. NATO leaders have expressed their support for the Vienna talks aimed at reviving the Iran nuclear deal to, quote, accomplish a mutual return to compliance with the JCPOA by the US and Iran. In a summit statement, the leaders of the military alliance said they support the restoring of non-proliferation benefits of the deal. The statement didn't mention the unilateral US withdrawal from the JCPOA and its imposition of sanctions on Iran. However, it's called on Iran to avoid further escalation by preserving the space for these talks. Iran has gradually reduced its commitments in retaliation for US measures Tehran says the deal stipulates that one party can scale back its commitments if others do not meet their obligations. And Iran says the U.S. must remove all sanctions in a verifiable manner before it returns to full compliance. Anti-Russia and anti-China rhetoric dominates a NATO summit in Brussels. It was Joe Biden's first meeting of the alliance since becoming U.S. president. A number of events took place close to where leaders held their talks, Jerome Hughes reports.
On the sidelines of the NATO summit in Brussels, Democrats abroad Belgium held a rally to coincide with the visit of Joe Biden. We sought their views on current efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal, which Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, tried to destroy.
I would actually encourage Biden to make that leap of faith and go ahead and say, listen, we're in, the sanctions are lifted, now it's up to you.
I don't know any more about the outcome than you do, but I'm confident that they're sincere about trying.
I'm crossing my fingers. He's allowed to do at least half of what he's trying to do, because there's a lot of obstruction in the Senate, of course.
Inside the summit, calls were made for the 30 countries in NATO to stand strongly together in order to face down current threats.
Especially at a time when authoritarian regimes like Russia and China challenge the rules-based international order.
Moscow and Beijing reject the criticism, and some analysts argue NATO is merely trying to justify its existence by creating adversaries. Also, there are divisions within NATO itself. For example, Turkey and Germany have important economic ties to Russia and China. Even the UK seems to be trying to tone down NATO HQ rhetoric.
I don't think anybody around the table today wants to descend into a new Cold War with China. I don't think that's where people are, but I think people see, they see challenges.
For his part, Joe Biden had this to say about Vladimir Putin ahead of a meeting with the Russian president on Wednesday.
He's bright, he's tough, and I have found that he is as they say, when he used to play ball, a worthy adversary.
There have not been huge protests to coincide with Biden's visit to Belgium. That's in stark contrast to when Donald Trump was here. Clearly, the optics are different on this occasion, but critics of U.S. foreign policy say fundamentally the same problems still exist. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Turning elsewhere now, the Yemeni army says it has carried out a fresh retaliatory drone strike hitting Saudi Arabia's Apa International Airport. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the strike was carried out by a class of 2K drones. He added that the attack was conducted in response to the kingdom's aggression and continued siege of Yemen. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. The kingdom's war has left tens of thousands of Yemenis dead, many of them women and children. Abdul Latif al-Washari joined us from the Yemeni capital Sana'a with more on the country's latest retaliatory attack on Saudi Arabia's Apa airport.
The Yemeni army launched this attack against Apa International Airport. As the Yemeni army spokesman said, Yahya Sarir, that it's in response to the continued aggression by the Saudi-led coalition and especially by Saudi Arabia. The Saudi regime has been intensifying its siege and blockade against Yemeni people. Only one oil vessel entered the country since the beginning of 2021, and they are trying to gain what they couldn't through the military and through the battles on the ground. They are trying to gain it by tightening the blockade on the Yemeni people. The Yemeni army has made it clear that it will continue attacking Saudi territories and the Saudi facilities as long as the war is held against the Yemeni people. Today, the Yemeni army released new footage for the wide-scale operation launched weeks ago in Jizan, and there are admits and contentions by the Saudi officers that they lost this battle.
Meanwhile, Yemenis have held a sit-in protest in front of the UN's office in the capital Sana'a to condemn the international community for turning a blind eye on the suffering of the impoverished nation amid the Saudi-led blockade. Abdul Latif al-Washadi has more in this report.
Yemen's medical workers came together in front of the UN office to vent their anger at the continued seizure of oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition, which has led to the closure of many medical facilities in the war-torn country.
The health sector has been badly affected by the siege in our country. Health facilities need fuel to be able to run medical equipment such as dialysis devices. The stopping these services means the death of thousands of patients. Today we need more medical equipment, but Saudi-led coalition prevents us from having access to them by its siege.
Yemen's Ministry of Health has announced repeatedly that most health facilities have to stop providing services due to the lack of fuel. Hundreds, including dialysis centers, are on the verge of total shutdown. The ministry has urged the international community to step in and to pressurize the Saudi-led coalition into releasing the seized oil tankers and opening Sana'a Airport.
More than 527 health facilities have been destroyed by the Saudi-led coalition airstrike so far. Meanwhile, hundreds of others have stopped providing health services due to the continued detention of oil ships en route to Yemen. This has caused an increase in the number of patients, a higher rate of death among infants and children, and spread of COVID-19 pandemic.
According to the UN, the Saudi war on Yemen, along with a years-long blockade, has driven the war-torn country into the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
People here say tightening the blockade will only put the lives of thousands of patients at risk and hamper the political solution, as the Yemeni army says it will continue advancing to Idlib city until it is fully liberated from the Saudi-backed forces.
Brings it into our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
global leaders that are having in Cornwall for the G7 summit have already found themselves in a changed world. Face masks and social distancing have replaced the usual hugs, handshakes, and cheek-pecking. The entourages have slimmed down, and the usual media circus has been muted, with protesters having to contend themselves with writing sand messages on the beach. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's environment correspondent Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, G7 Leaders Face Make-or-Break Moment in Climate Crisis. Stay with us for more of Fiona Harvey's article. Global leaders arriving in Cornwall for the G7 summit have already found themselves in a changed world. Face masks and social distancing have replaced the usual hugs, handshakes, and cheek-pecking. The entourages have slimmed down, and the usual media circus has been muted, with protesters having to contend themselves with writing sand messages on the beach. Boris Johnson has faced ridicule and accusations of hypocrisy for travelling to Carbis Bay by private jet. Some of the other leaders have been more concerned about the extent to which quarantine rules apply to them. But amid the ever-present reminders that 2021 is a year unlike any other, one of the biggest changes will be entirely invisible. Carbon dioxide is now at a higher level in the atmosphere than at any point in the last 4 million years, newly released data has shown. The world has entered uncharted territory where global heating is concerned and greenhouse gas emissions are rising strongly still. The message could not be clearer. If the world fails to act now, the future will be changed beyond anything the coronavirus pandemic has brought about. Lord Stern, the climate economist, said, "This is a crucial moment in history. Either we recover from the pandemic in a strong and sustainable way, or we don't. We are at a real fork in the road. This decade is decisive." Scientists have made it clear that greenhouse gas emissions must be halved by 2030 if the world is to stay within 1.5 degrees Celsius of global heating, the threshold beyond which extreme weather will take hold. Small islands and low-lying areas will face inundation, and swathes of the world will face water stress and heat waves. Stern pointed to the checkered progress of the past 10 years, in which the cost of renewable energy has plunged and technology such as electric vehicles has increased, but in which progress on cutting emissions overall has been painfully slow. The last decade was not very good, and this next decade could be just as bad or even worse if we make the wrong choices, he said. G7 countries are responding. All of the leaders coming to Cornwall, from United States, United Kingdom, Japan, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, and the European Union, have affirmed their commitment to holding temperature rises to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, the lower limit set out in the 2015 Paris Agreement. All have long-term targets to reach net zero emissions by 2050, and nearly all have targets to cut carbon in the next decade. The United Kingdom has led with the goal of cutting emissions by 68% by 2030 and by 78% by 2035, based on 1990 levels. The United States will halve emissions by 2030 based on 2005 levels, and the European Union will make cuts by at least 55% by 2030 on a 1990 baseline. However, current plans under the Paris Climate Accord from Japan and Canada have been criticized by campaigners as inadequate, and they are under pressure to toughen their targets before COP26, the crucial United Nations climate talks to be held in Glasgow, Scotland, this November. been also progress in the run-up to the Cornwall summit. All of the G7 countries have agreed to halt the funding of coal and coal-fired power stations, a huge step forward in making a global move away from the dirtiest fossil fuel. Yet none of this is enough. Global carbon dioxide output is forecast to jump by an almost record amount this year as the world returns to economic growth using fossil fuels, instead of making the leap needed to renewable energy and low-carbon energy. G7 countries are falling behind on the green recovery from COVID-19 that experts have been urging for more than a year, and reliance on coal has increased in some parts of the world, including the United States of America. The situation is worse in non-G7 countries. China, the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases and second biggest economy, is not represented at the G7 summit. China's reliance on coal has increased further in the recovery from COVID-19, despite the country's long-term goal of net zero emissions by 2050. Fatih Birol, executive director of International Energy Agency, IEA, said that while rich countries were cutting their greenhouse gas emissions, some developing countries would continue to increase theirs unless they could gain far more investment in shifting to a low-carbon economy. Fatih Birol said more than 90% of emissions in the next two decades will come from emerging economies, but they are less than 20% of global clean energy investment. He added, "If we can't accelerate the clean energy transition in these countries, I believe this will be the most critical fault line in global efforts to reach climate goals." To fund the shift to clean energy and to cope with the effects of climate breakdown, developing countries will need help from the richer countries. So far, promises of finance have not been met. Under a long-standing pledge made in 2009, poor countries were supposed to receive $100 billion a year from public and private sources by 2020. That target has certainly been missed, and the pressure is now on the G7, the grouping of the world's wealthiest countries, to find a way of plugging the gap, a crucial step in gaining developing countries' backing for any climate deal at the COP26, United Nations Climate Summit in Glasgow, Scotland.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of Imam Khamenei, the Supreme Leader of Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, both from the Islamic House of Qom. Brother Ali, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much for inviting
You're
me.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
So, June 18th, 2021 is the day that the presidential election is going to be held in Islamic Republic of Iran. And what is interesting is that in the Islamic Republic of Iran, the term republic refers to the role of the people in their own fate. One of the things which is very important in establishing the fate of the people in this country is voting for the president. And the interesting point about the voting system in Iran and the elections is that every vote is counted. It is in contrast to what's happening in the Western world, like electoral college, you know, votes or something like that, state votes or something like that. Every vote and every person can vote. You know, a person who is that that's right.
Eligible.
Mature, eligible, 18 years old, isn't it?
Yeah.
18 years old, we can say can vote. Every 4 years, a new president is going to be elected as the president of Islamic Republic of Iran. The leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, in his latest speech, very much emphasized on this Jumhuriya aspect, or the republic, or the people's role aspect of the elections, and the role that the people have in, discerning their own destiny and fate of the future of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Said Mohsen Naqvi, let's start with you, brother. So, this type of election in Iran, how do you find it different from the other elections all across the world? You yourself have traveled to different countries, okay? And you know the models and the systems over there. What is the main difference between this one and the other ones in other countries?
Well, if I want to just compare the presidential election,
yes,
with the other presidential elections in the world, because we have two types of elections, governance in the countries. One is the prime minister, where the people like choose ministers and then they choose a prime minister from amongst them. And then there is a presidential election that there are a couple of candidates who comes and they do their own campaign and everyone votes for them. When I compare the presidential election in Iran and the rest of the world, there are some good points about the Iranian presidential election. And one of them is that, when a person has been elected, the rest are generally submissive to the decision. They respect the decision.
Okay.
Number two, people do believe that their votes are counted.
Mm-hmm.
Because generally in the other countries, we see that if someone is being elected, then these kind of things started, like the discussions that my vote wasn't counted, or there was a kind of, we can say a fraud, or the person was pre-elected, and these kind of things. Yes, in the anti-Iranian regime, we do see these things about Iran. But within Iran, we don't see such things within Iran. Yes,
right.
The media, which is propagating against the Islamic Republic of Iran, yes, they talk about all these things, but that is not the criteria,
mm-hmm,
to see. It's the general public.
Mm-hmm.
And when people choose someone, obviously, they know that. When they vote someone, they know that it's been their vote. And the way they participate with the energy which they have, generally, when it is election, they show from the morning, like the show starts from the morning,
yes,
on the TV.
This time is 7 in the morning till 2 at 9, at night.
Yeah, midnight. It's sometimes
midnight.
It's midnight.
Because of the coronavirus, the time is extended in order, people...
To prevent people staying in lines.
Yeah, staying in lines or big lines,
Too close to each other.
Yeah.
So we can see, a big public,
yes,
queued in the line for the elections.
Yes.
Sometimes we've seen families, generally people just go and vote and come back.
Mm-hmm.
Here we see families, small,
yes,
kids,
yes,
they're with the parents.
Okay.
And the parents are teaching how to do this.
Yes.
So this is very important. And this thing shows that, when it is said it's a religious obligation upon them to select a true manager for themselves, they're really doing it. And on the other hand, there is another view which I've seen in the people of Iran, and that is when we ask them, like, why you gone for voting, for example, they say it is an obligation upon us, number one. Number two, it's we want to basically show our enemies,
mm-hmm,
that this is our power.
That's right.
This is us.
Mm-hmm.
That if you say that there is a need of change of regime in Iran, in the elections we come and we show that there is no need of change in the regime.
That's right.
We are here, we are present here with the maximum number of people participating in elections,
okay,
to show that the majority of people do not want any change in the regime.
That's,
and that's
right,
what we can see. You can see also in the Western media, or the media which is doing propaganda against Iran, that they're talking about. For example, a couple of weeks ago, we had this election in Syria.
Yes.
The Bashar Assad's,
yes,
he won with the 90% of, votes.
Yes.
And that was a big victory for Syria, because, the Western powers, they're talking about the change of the regime in Syria, and in the people of Syria, they showed that we do not want any kind of change.
So it means that election actually brings immunity to the system and the states.
Yes.
And elections, presidential elections in Iran is a guarantee to the whole system. I think to the Islamic revolution of Iran, a kind of confirmation for that. But the case is that, you know, somehow, even inside Iran, the people are comparing the presidential election to the Western models, and I think that the Western model is not applicable in Iran, because it, you know,
if they're comparing based on democracy
mm-hmm. and based on the free liberal capitalism, they have their own models, but Iran is not successful.
The main problem is people do not know about the election system of the West.
West, that's right.
You know, for example, in France,
yes.
if there is a presidential election, there is a committee.
Yes.
There is a council
yes.
who checks the ability of candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, I think, 6 or 9 people. Like every president who's been president, ex-president, is part of that council. And other than that, there are like 3 other people who have been selected. So these are the people who basically check the eligibility of these candidates.
That's right.
And if the candidate has such abilities, or he is eligible, he fulfills the conditions, then he's allowed to participate in the election. Same is the case in Iran. We have the Guardianship Council,
yes.
who checks the eligibility of the candidates.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, when we want to have like election, like as in West, there are certain points, but that is not highlighted in the news from themselves, like from the Western media, we can say. In Iran, because everything is Islamic, and obviously this is very important, that a person who wants to become a candidate should be eligible, should be, for example, you know, his zahir, his apparent, should be, you know, someone who's following the Islamic laws, and he's submissive to that, he has other conditions as well
that
are mentioned in the constitution.
Yes.
So you should fulfill that.
Okay.
Because it's Islamic, so in Iran, everything has been highlighted, from the guardianship council
yes.
to the level, like when they have a time, a week or two, for, you know,
for
appeal.
Campaigns
yeah,
or
for appeal, and after that is a time of campaign, and
yes.
there are like dialogues
and
all those, debates and all those.
That's right.
So because everything is being made apparent
okay.
in Iran,
yes.
that's why maybe some of people in Iran, because they're unaware of what's happening in the West,
mm-hmm.
that's why they might say, like, we want the system as in the West. Whereas if you bring the Western system, then the candidates will be lesser than what you have right now
mm-hmm.
In the elections.
Yeah, I think, and this is not the point, because, you know, even in the West itself, I think there are some differences between, for example, the UK and the US, okay?
UK is a
and also the other
prime
European
minister.
Countries.
No,
yes.
In UK, we have a prime minister.
Yes, I know, and on the other European countries.
Yeah.
But, you know, an Eastern country, a Muslim land, has its own system.
Yes.
And the good point about Islamic, this type of election, is that it could be a role model also for other Muslim countries.
Yes, definitely.
This could be a role model, we can say, and a model, a new model that observes Islam and keeps track on the path of Islam. At the same time, the people's votes are counted, because some people say that when you have the system of velayat-e-faqih, what is the role of the people? But they don't know that, you know, this velayat-e-faqih that we have now, Ayatollah Khamenei, here and there, on different occasions, has emphasized on the role of the people,
mm-hmm.
that they might have, we can
again,
say, in establishing their own
it's
future.
It's very important that
yes.
Wali-e-Faqih himself is involving people in
mm-hmm.
the decisions.
Yes.
So that tomorrow, if something is happening,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's very easy to blame one person
okay.
and say, like, it's because of you.
Mm-hmm.
But when we are involved in such a decision, then
yes.
it's very hard to do that.
Okay.
We cannot
mm-hmm.
back up from the
That's
things
right.
that we have, the decisions that we make. We cannot back.
Yes.
So it's very important, and it's also a good way of, you know, ruling or governing
That's right.
a place, so that everyone is involved.
And we are, I think, somehow, how can I say, we are unexperienced, because 40 years have passed the Islamic Revolution of Iran, people are still in the process of tests and trials, okay? So day by day, and, you know, president after president, we will get to the high qualified president that would be approved by an Islamic system. This is, I think, natural and normal.
I just remembered when you said 40 years, you know, in some of the narrations we have, mental maturity or intellectual maturity comes after 40 years. These 40 years, the things that happened in Iran, the president election and the presidents that you had, now some kind of maturity has come in the people, inshallah.
But I think, again, that portraying the people's participation, every 4 years when the presidential election is held in Iran, the foreign press are over here. They have conferences over here, okay? So they are recording the people's participation in the votes and the voting system and the votes, you know, on the polling stations. But the case is that when they get back to their own media, a different picture is shown to the people. For example, the decisions that have been made before selecting the candidates who are going to be the president of Islamic Republic of Iran, and this media, I think, has influenced the people inside Iran too somehow. I do want to say again, getting back to this Ahad-e Millat, that you know, when we say this Ahad-e Millat, I mean every person among the nation has a vote, okay? And this vote is respected. But some criticisms are made by the Western media that before holding the elections, these votes are clear. And I think controlling the mechanism of the voting stations and the voting system is something which is done by Islamic Republic of Iran. Do you accept this criticism, brother?
It's a wrong, impression that actually they want to put in the minds of the people through their media empire that they actually always active over the Iranian people and Iranian nation.
Right.
But here we clearly see that people are free in their voting, and they actually find it as their own right to vote whenever they are interested. And there is no sort of prevention from the government or pressure from the government to ask a group and to vote and not to vote. So we see it, but the picture and image that they are actually making from the Islamic Republic is something that is twisted, and everyone, at least inside the country, know that. But since they are more active in the media, so they usually and naturally propagate what they believe in. But we see that much elections that we have had in our country can really be seen in the most developed and, let's say, as they claim, the most democratic countries as well. So more than 40 elections in almost 42 years is something surprising.
Even the villages in Iran and the rural areas,
even
the navies on the sea, and you know,
we have heard from
the
candidates.
We have
heard from the candidates of presidential election that we send helicopters to take the villagers' votes.
That's why we do that.
Yeah, this is what is being done here. I don't know if the same procedure and process is being practiced overseas in all these countries, that they're actually their voice of equality and justice has deafened the whole world. I don't know if it is being practiced, but here this is what we do. Once, let's say 10 years ago, actually I was involved in the election process, and I see how difficult it is for those who are going to villages to collect the votes of the people. And usually people are totally free to vote for whoever they like.
That's all right. And the mosque as the polling centers for Iran, you know, in Iran's system of polling station, that they select the mosques in neighborhoods in order to go there and vote for the president. This is really beautiful, you know, makes the mosque again as the societal and the social role that the mosque may have in adhering and showing the people together. This is really
very
beautiful.
These are
happening.
Beautiful things that we can see in elections, mosques, and what we call them Husseiniyas, the places that people gather for Islamic assemblies. These are the places usually.
Also, the gathering between the young people, you know, in the presidential elections before coronavirus, I mean, the previous rounds of presidential election, usually the young people used to chit chat and debate inside the mosques. After the prayers, okay, sitting together, talking about different candidates from two opposing sides, okay? And about their plans, and this is really beautiful. Okay, thank you much, Brother Adir Abiyan Said Mohsen Nawi, for your nice elaboration regarding the role of the people in establishing their own future through presidential election. Iranian presidential election this year is held on June 18th, 2021, and the people of Iran, inshallah, will participate in this big, we can say, political scene of Islamic Republic of Iran. This was what we tackled through the speeches and the thoughts of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in the program Viewpoints. Dear listeners, you can visit our website and this program, other episodes of this program, at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel and Instagram page under the title Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi aman.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Labeling COVID-19 the Chinese disease or naming a variant Indian serves little purpose other than to hand a gift to the ignorant and the ill-intentioned. Those who are either unable or unwilling to understand what is going on, or who are quick to seize on any evidence that can be manipulated to reinforce their prejudices. I prepared for you an article written by Jonathan Gornall, a British journalist formerly with The Times, who has lived and worked in West Asia and is now based in the United Kingdom. The piece is titled Renaming COVID-19 Variants Will Help Fight Racism. The article has been published by Syndication Bureau website. From the Ascock-Scott syndrome to Zumbush psoriasis, generations of clinicians and medical researchers have earned fame, fortune, and a kind of immortality through the honor of having the rare disease or rare disorder they have identified named after them. But but when an entire regional country finds itself associated with a deadly infectious disease, the result is more of a curse than an honor. Over the years, there have been plenty of examples, including the Spanish flu, responsible for the 1918 pandemic that claimed more lives than the First World War, and which didn't originate in Spain. Also, the Ebola virus, named after the Ebola River in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where it was first identified in 1976. The Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, identified in more than 20 countries since 2012, but linked first to camel-to-human transmission in Qatar and Saudi Arabia in 2012. Back in May 2015, the World Health Organization, WHO, decided enough was enough and called on scientists, national authorities, and the media to follow the best practices in naming new human infectious diseases to minimize unnecessary negative effects on nations, economies, and peoples. Dr. Keiji Fukuda, Assistant Director General for Health Security at the World Health Organization, said, "The use of names such as Middle East Respiratory Syndrome has had unintended negative impacts by stigmatizing certain communities or certain economic sectors in certain regions of the world." He added, "Disease names really do matter to people who are directly affected by the disease. We've seen certain disease names provoke a backlash against members of particular religious or ethnic communities, create unjustified barriers to travel, commerce, and trade, and trigger needless slaughter of food animals. This can have serious consequences for people's lives and people's livelihoods." Unfortunately, the initiative wasn't backdated, which means that the Middle East will forever be associated with a coronavirus that caused the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS-CoV. Beginning of last year, along came SARS-CoV-2, the novel coronavirus behind the COVID-19 pandemic and the cause to date of more than 3.7 million deaths around the world. For a while, following the then US President Donald Trump's unfortunate lead, even CNN was calling it the Chinese virus or the Chinese disease. But in February 2020, the World Health Organization officially named the disease COVID-19, a name that stuck. Unfortunately, the virus then started to mutate, and suddenly it was open season in the name game. Starting in December of 2020, a series of variants of the virus began to emerge, with each one named for the nation in which it first surfaced. The UK, South Africa, Brazil, and India all found themselves so named and shamed. At the end of May, with the announcement that henceforth all current and future variants of the coronavirus would be known by the letters of the Greek alphabet applied in the order in which they emerged, the World Health Organization took steps to end the practice. If it works, and worryingly many media outlets around the world have yet to adopt the new naming system, the UK strain of the virus, the first to have cropped up back in December, will be known as the Alpha variant. That's easy enough to remember, but with few in the modern world familiar with all 24 letters of the Greek alphabet, it remains to be seen whether Beta, the South African variant, Gamma, the Brazilian variant, Delta and Kappa, both Indian variants, Epsilon and Iota, the US variant, and Theta, the Philippines variant, will catch on. And quite what will happen naming-wise should the number of SARS-CoV-2 variants top 24 remains to be seen. Regardless, the World Health Organization's well-intentioned initiative is to be applauded. We live in a time when opinions can be formed and individuals and entire races maligned and libeled at the drop of a tweet or a Facebook posting. Labeling COVID-19 the Chinese virus or the Chinese disease, or naming a variant of the virus the Indian variant, serves little purpose other than to hand a gift to the ignorant and the ill-intentioned, those who are either unable or unwilling to understand what is going on, or who are quick to seize on any evidence that can be manipulated to reinforce their prejudices. In May of last year, United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres spoke of the tsunami of hate and xenophobia, scapegoating and scaremongering that has been unleashed by the coronavirus pandemic. Guterres added, anti-foreigner sentiment has surged online and in the streets. Anti-Semitic conspiracy theories have spread, and COVID-19-related anti-Muslim attacks have occurred. Migrants and refugees have been vilified as a source of the virus. Attacks linked to variant naming have taken place. In May of this year, Singaporean Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong took to social media to condemn a racist attack on a woman of Indian descent who was kicked and abused for not wearing a face mask, committed in Singapore while exercising, which the woman was at the time. Prime Minister of Singapore, Lee Hsien Loong, wrote, public anxiety over the pandemic does not justify racist attitudes and racist actions, much less physically abusing and assaulting someone because she belongs to a particular race. As Guterres stressed, COVID-19 does not care who we are, where we live, what we believe, or about any other distinction. The whole world is in this fight together. And we will win it not by turning on one another, but by fighting side by side, united by our humanity and our common cause rather than divided by petty prejudices.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.